All right, let's go ahead and get started tonight. Some of us might have grown up watching The Lone Ranger. I know nobody here was alive when it first came out. I wasn't alive, but I grew up watching the reruns. And in every single episode in which The Lone Ranger appeared, always at the end, after he had beaten up the bad guy and rescued the ones in distress, he would jump on Silver's back, and then he would say what? Thank you. Hi-ho, Silver, away, right? And then in every single episode, it was inevitable that someone would ask the question, who was that masked man, right? Well, in this lesson, we're going to focus on the person of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ, as most of us are aware here, is the one person that everybody needs to answer the question, who was he? Everybody needs to answer that. Josh McDowell, in his book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict, if you don't own it, you need to make that a part of your library. He worded it this way: was Jesus a legend, lord, liar, or lunatic? And when you really think about it, those are really the only four possibilities. In all the years I've studied Christian evidences and thought about the person of Jesus Christ and who he could be, I can't conjure up anything else other than these four options. And so we need to talk about this because, you know, everybody in the Bible wanted to know who he was. Even his enemies wanted to know who he was. Typically, when you're an enemy of somebody, you could care less who they are because you're their enemy. You don't want to know them. But the enemies of Jesus, they wanted to know him, right? Matthew 4, verse 3, when Satan approaches Jesus in the wilderness to tempt him, he says, "If you're the Son of God," and then he said, "Prove it," basically. In Luke 5:21, the scribes and the Pharisees asked, who is this man who speaks blasphemies? In Luke 9, verse 9, King Herod said, "Who is this man about whom I hear such things?" And so it's interesting that the enemies of Jesus wanted to know who he was. These were not his friends, but they didn't just dismiss him. They wanted to know who he was. And then there were people who wanted to know who Jesus was, who you might call more neutral. I mean, these weren't people who were necessarily pro-Jesus or anti-Jesus, but they were sort of on the sidelines observing the things that he said and the things that they did, and they were wanting to know who he was. In Luke 7, verse 49, the people who were at Simon's house for that big party said, "Who is this man who forgives sins?" They didn't know anything about him, but they were intrigued by his actions and his words, and they wanted to know who he was. In Matthew 21, verse 10, all the city was stirred and said, "Who is this?" You know, the Lone Ranger had one person every single episode asking this, but this is an entire city wanting to know who Jesus is. In John 8:25, the Jews say very simply, "Who are you?" And then in John 12:34, the crowd say, "Who is this Son of Man?" So the neutral were interested. The enemies wanted to know. The neutrals wanted to know. And then there were people that were interested that wanted to know. There were people who were very interested in Jesus, and they wanted to know more about him. People like Zacchaeus in Luke 19, who climbed on that tree to get a glimpse of Jesus so that he might learn a little bit more about him. People like the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, who after speaking with Jesus, she goes back to her village and she says, "This is not the Christ, is it?" In other words, who is this man? And then there were people who were healed by Jesus, had no idea who he was, but they wanted to know. In John chapter 5, the lame man asked, "Who is it that healed me?" And when Jesus said, "Do you want to know?" he said, "Yes, I want to know." And in John 9:36, the blind man asked, "Who is the Lord that I may believe in him?" And so those healed by Jesus wanted to know who he was. And then even his loyal followers wanted to know. Of course, we all know Matthew chapter 16. Where Jesus asks the apostles, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And then Peter gives the answer that he gives, causing Peter to then, for Jesus to then ask, "Who do you say that I am?" And then Peter gives the answer, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," right? In Mark 4:41, we're told they became afraid and said, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" This is the apostles asking this. And in Matthew 11, verse 3, even John the Baptist asks, "Are you the expected one, or do we look for another?" I mean, Jesus had no greater friend than John the Baptist, and even he said, "Who are you?" Isn't that interesting? So we see all these passages of people asking who Jesus is, and it really begs the question, why is this so important for us today? I mean, because assuming he's not a legend, which we're going to address, at the very least, Jesus Christ has died and he's left this earth, depending on what you believe about him. And so from a worldly perspective, that would put him like way behind us. So why do we need to be asking this question today? Well, the first thing I say to the skeptic is this. If you've never read those four biographical accounts about Jesus Christ that we call the Gospels, you need to read them. Because you just cannot appreciate why a question like this is so important unless you know his story. Because there has never been in history a man quite like Jesus of Nazareth. Even those who disagree on how he should be followed, every single one of them claim to follow him. And that is very significant. And when you read the gospel accounts, you're going to attempt to try to answer that question. And you want to know why? Because Jesus confuses us. He really does. When he tells us things like, if your enemy strikes you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. Or when he says things like, love your enemies. Or if he says things like, do unto others as you would have them to do unto you. These are not the kind of answers that you would expect. I've studied the gospel accounts for years, and just when I feel like I've reached a point where I think I understand where Jesus is coming from on some things, he throws me for a loop again, and I have to reevaluate. Because the more you study him, the more you just become so astounded by his actions and his words. He really confuses us. He does things we wouldn't have expected, and he says things that we wouldn't have predicted. Does he do this because he wants to confuse us? No. The things that he does because his ways are so much higher than our ways and his thoughts so much higher than our thoughts, and we just can't comprehend it. I mean, we can come closer to it as we study it, but we can't perfectly comprehend it. So he confuses us, but really what Jesus is doing is he's challenging us, and he demands so much from us, doesn't he? When he says, take up your cross daily and follow me, that's a huge challenge. When he says, if you love father and mother more than me, you're not worthy of me, that's difficult. Jesus constantly tells us that we have to give stuff up, that we have to surrender ourselves, that we have to be able to go the extra mile for other people. And he doesn't just say, come follow me. He says, come worship me. But then he also says, come be like me. And so this is a question when I'm talking to skeptics, they are going to have to answer for themselves. They can't plead neutrality. They have got to answer this question, who is Jesus Christ? And I want to begin talking about those four things, legend, Lord, liar, lunatic. How about before we do, we have a word of prayer, since we neglected to do that. Chandler, would you mind leading us in that?
Father, thank you for giving us another wonderful day where you come together and study the words. Please help us just do so in a way that we will please you. Just please help us to get something out of it. Just please with us as we go throughout the rest of this week and just help us to always just glorify you and live our lives right on your side. In Christ's name we pray.
Amen. Thank you. Okay, let's talk about first, was Jesus a legend, meaning did he even exist? Was there truly a man by the name of Jesus of Nazareth, and did he at least live? Or is his existence the greatest hoax to have ever been pulled off in human history? Because you have to keep in mind that this man has had a profound influence on the entire world, including everybody that is sitting in this room. I mean, time is measured by his birth. It's why we use the acronyms BC and AD. Men and women have been tortured to death, giving their lives, defending the story of Jesus Christ and his resurrection from the dead. So did he exist, or do we just lump him into the same categories? We might lump others like Robin Hood and King Arthur. I will go ahead and tell you before we actually look at the evidence that of all the positions that we could take about Jesus Christ, this is the weakest one. No one even began suggesting that Jesus was a legend until the 1800s, and the ones who suggested it did it on the basis of no evidence, just biased conjecture. The fact is that the testimonies and the biographies of Jesus' life, both from Christian and non-Christians, is just too significant to ignore. Let's look at some of the evidence. First, Jesus had more biographies written about him than any other person in the ancient world. The Roman Emperor Tiberius died in 37 AD, and his earliest known biographies were written between 110 and 120 AD by Tacitus and Suetonius. That's a 70-80 year gap. And then you've got Alexander the Great. He died in 323 BC. His earliest biography is from 130 AD. It was written by a man named Arian. That's a 450-year gap. But Jesus has four biographies written about him, and all of them were written within a generation of his death. That is simply too quick of a time for any legendary material to develop about him that would corrupt the facts of his life. And so by comparing Jesus' biographies to other ancient secular history, we can measure the rate at which legend is added, and one generation is simply too quick a time. Secondly, if you consider the actual biographies themselves, the gospel accounts of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each of these gospels were written by four different men giving their four very different perspectives to four different groups of people. You've got Matthew's gospel that was written to the Jews. You've got Mark's gospel that was written to the Romans. Luke's was written to the Greeks. John's gospel was really written to everyone, regardless of culture. But what makes the evidence of these four gospel accounts so strong is both the unity and the diversity. That's very important. Now, by unity, I mean they all tell the same story. They all arrive to the same conclusion about Jesus of Nazareth, but they were also diverse in that some gospel accounts are more specific in other areas than other gospel accounts. Some tell the same story, but from a slightly different point of view. Now, skeptics will hone in on this. Skeptics will say that the differences in the gospel accounts actually weaken the credibility of the gospels. And if they were true eyewitnesses, they'd be exactly alike in every single detail. That's what skeptics will say. But the skeptic who makes this claim hasn't really thought this through. Because in our judicial system, when witnesses are called to testify for or against another individual, there are things that a judge and a jury are going to look out for. So imagine that you have four witnesses who come on the witness stand and they're describing the story or situation, and their testimonies are word for word the same as the others. What conclusion would you reach about them? Well, we would claim that those witnesses had collaborated with one another prior to testifying, or that someone had told them exactly what to say. And so in that situation, the testimony couldn't be trusted. That's what we call collusion. However, we would trust their testimonies if all of them had witnessed the same event, some independent from another, described the same event beginning to end, but the details of their descriptions were just a little bit different. And that's why we trust the Gospels. Not in spite of its diversity, but because of it. It's the gospel's diversity that gives these four men's testimonies credibility, and not the other way around. And then third, there was no motive for the apostles to invent legendary material about Jesus. Pagans and Jews, they were hostile to the message of Jesus being God. Politically, Rome viewed the deity of Christ as subversive to the state, and that's why they routinely killed Christians who wouldn't bow to the emperor in worship. And so while the message certainly brought Christians hope, it also placed a big fat target on their head. And so there wasn't strong motive for them inventing such a message and then dying for a lie. Fourth, the apostles didn't change the story, even when it would have benefited their reputation to do so. The apostles wrote that they themselves were unintelligent, that they were uneducated, uncaring. They wrote events that made them out to look cowardly and doubtful. Peter was even called Satan by Jesus in Mark 8, verse 33, and it was Peter's account that the Gospel of Mark is recording, according to the early church fathers. The apostles placed women at the empty tomb of Jesus as the first eyewitnesses of the resurrection, during a time period where women were treated like second-class citizens, unable to even testify in a court of law. Why would they do that if they're making this stuff up? And the apostles wrote that Jesus was accused of all kinds of crazy things. They wrote that he was accused of being deranged, deceitful. They wrote that he was accused of being a drunkard, demon-possessed. He was also called a Samaritan in John chapter 8. And these were by both enemies and his family. They even record in the Gospels that many of Jesus' followers deserted him, like in John 6, verse 66. You know, it would have been far easier if this is just legendary material being developed for the apostles to just leave out this stuff if they were only interested in developing fiction. The fact that they didn't lends to its credibility. And then fifth, we have plenty of secular historical records that prove the existence of Jesus, even from those who were not believers in what he taught or what he claimed about himself. We're not going to look at all of these in detail, but just a few. Tacitus, who lived from 55 to 120 AD, he was considered one of the greatest historians of ancient Rome. And he wrote about Nero, saying that he punished with the most exquisite tortures the persons commonly called Christians who were hated for their enormities. Christus, same word for Christ, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, the procurator of Judea in the reign of Tiberius, but the pernicious superstition repressed for a time broke out again, not only through Judea where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome also. This is not a believer, but he's writing facts out. Josephus, who lived from 38 to sometime around 100, a little bit more AD, famous Jewish historian, we've all heard of him. He wrote about Jesus in his Jewish Antiquity, saying that Jesus was a wise man who did surprising feats, taught many, won over followers from among Jews and Greeks. He said that Jesus was believed to be the Messiah. Now, he didn't believe that, but that's what he said that was believed about Jesus. And that he was accused by the Jewish leaders, was condemned to be crucified by Pilate, and was considered to be resurrected. The Talmudists, you'll remember we talked about them last quarter. They wrote, but sometime between 87 and 200, we learned that Jesus was conceived out of wedlock, gathered disciples, made blasphemous claims about himself, and worked miracles, but these miracles are attributed to sorcery and not to God. Again, they didn't believe in what he taught and said, but they're acknowledging the fact that this man existed. And we could look at those other two, but these are going to be on the website. Let's move on for time's sake. Thallus, around AD 52, was one of the first Gentile writers. He wrote to try to explain away the darkness that occurred when Jesus died on the cross. And Marbar and Serapion is a pretty good one too, but for time's sake, we'll just skip that one. The bottom line is this: the evidence for Jesus' existence, it is so abundant in both Christian and non-Christian sources, it is inconceivable to suggest that he was a legend. If you were going to take that position. It's late. If you're going to take that position, you're in an incredibly small crowd of people, and you're going to have to actually produce evidence that would come about at the same time some of these other writings are, or prove that these writings are false, rather than just basing this on pure bias conjecture. You've got to produce early non-Christian references that would suggest such a position, but there are none. Even those who believed him to be a phony did not deny that he existed or that he claimed the things that he claimed. All right, so Jesus was absolutely not a legend. We're going to keep going on and talk about some things Jesus said about himself. Any thoughts on that before we keep going, though? Any thoughts on Jesus being a legend? All right, so he's not a legend. He existed. We need to know who he is. There's never been a man who has spoken like him. And so let's let him answer this. Let's go and see what he actually said. In Mark 14, Jesus is on trial before the high priest, who is questioning him about who he is. And in Mark 14, verse 61, it says he kept silent, didn't answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Now, that term "Blessed One," that's referring to God. They didn't want to mention the name of God in this case, and so they just call him the Blessed One. So they're asking him, "Are you the Son of the Blessed One?" Not, "Are you a son of God?" Not, "Are you a son of a God?" They are asking if he is the unique one. And he says this, "I am." "And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." He doesn't say, "I could be." He doesn't say, "I might be." Or "I think I am." No, he says, "I am." Now, the reason that I'm emphasizing the statement "like I am" is because there are people who like to claim that Jesus never said that he was the Son of God. They'll claim that this was thrust upon him by people who misunderstood his place, and that all Jesus wanted to be was this prophet, this follower of God, this good man. But here he admits to being the Son of God. He says, "I am." In fact, this is the same thing he says to Peter in Matthew 16, verse 15 and 16. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Jesus doesn't tell Peter, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, you overstated some things. That's not really correct." No, he is admitting it here. "Yes, you're right. I am the Son of God." His own words. John 8:58, Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am." Now, before we look at the next verse, let's talk about this, because on the surface, that sounds like the worst grammar that you could ever read, doesn't it? I mean, it looks like he's mixing his tenses and that he should be saying, "Before Abraham was, I was," not "Before Abraham was, I am." But this isn't about grammar. This isn't a phrase. It's a title. I am the name of God. Why would he pick a name like that? Because it means that God is always in the present tense. Go back as far as you want to, God is there. Go as forward in time as you can, God is there. Who's in the past? I am. Who's in the present? I am. Who's in the future? I am. Go back to the 1950s. Where is Ryan Hasty? Not even a thought, right? What about in the year 3000? Won't even be here. Right now I'm here, but with God, he is the great I am, because he is always there. It is an exclusive name for God with no beginning, no end, the same way in which God introduced himself to Moses at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. And so Jesus is taking upon himself the very name of God. And if you don't think the context warrants that, then just look at verse 59 and how they responded to that statement. Because it says, "Therefore they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple." Why? Because they understood exactly what he was saying, that he was claiming divinity. And any man under Jewish law who would take divinity upon himself was to be publicly executed by stoning. John chapter 10 is another good one. John 10, beginning verse 30, Jesus says, "I and the Father are one." The Jews picked up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, "I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you stoning me?" The Jews answered him, "For a good work we don't stone you, but for blasphemy, and because you, being a man, make yourself out to be God." See, the Jews understood exactly what he meant when he said, "I and the Father are one." And Jesus doesn't respond to their attempts to stone him with, "Whoa, I've been misquoted, I didn't say that." No, he instead acknowledges that that is exactly who he is. And then in John 20, when Thomas encounters the resurrected Lord, he says this in verse 28, "Thomas answered and said to him, 'My Lord and my God.'" And then notice Jesus' response. Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, have you believed?" Believed what? Believed that he is God and that he came to earth as God and dwelt among men, the great Emmanuel. And not only that, but Jesus accepted people's worship. From these verses right here, we won't look at them in detail. He never corrected them when they did so. And so, is this some kind of mistake? Was this thrust upon Jesus? No, these are the very words of Jesus himself. And so now the question becomes this. What do we do with those claims that we just looked at? We really only have two choices now. These claims are either true or false. They have to be one or the other. Now, if these claims are false, that gives us two options for why these claims are false, given that the reliability in the New Testament is intact, which we've already looked at. First, if it is false and he knew it was false when he made those claims, that would make him a liar, right? All right, so let's talk about that. Any thoughts before we do that? Any comments? All right, let's look at the claim that Jesus was a liar. Could Jesus have been a liar? In other words, maybe he existed. You know, he was around, everybody knew who he was, but surely he was just some other charlatan with grandiose ideas and an ego big enough to say anything in order to gain a following. That's what some would say. Well, I want us to think about the consequences of holding to this particular position. If Jesus claimed to be God, but he knew he wasn't, it means this. It means he knowingly led people to eternal damnation. The Old Testament is very clear on what is to happen to those who begin false movements. Also, it means Jesus was the worst kind of hypocrite, because he's pretending to be someone that he is not, and he's trying to bring others under his fold. And if Jesus was a liar, then it would have made him the biggest fool to have ever lived, because he took his teaching to the cross itself, and he endured one of the most wretched tortures that a man could endure, all while defending a claim that he knew to be false. I mean, we know that people die for things that they believe to be true, but they never willingly give their life for things that they know are false, especially in the way that Jesus gave his life. But I want to suggest to you that the evidence of his character from Scripture does not fit that of a pathological liar. First of all, Jesus taught his followers to be honest at all costs, saying in Matthew 5:37, let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, anything beyond these is of evil. He also taught his followers to give sacrificially to others. In John 15:13, he said, greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. And he taught his followers the importance of giving, saying in Matthew 5:40, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn him away from him who wants to borrow from you. But, you know, it's not just the fact that he said those things. Every single one of us that's read these biographical accounts, we know that he lived those things. He was brutally honest with all those that he engaged with, even when it cost him personally. The record of his life is clear that not only did he die for mankind, but he sacrificed himself daily to help others and to teach others to the point where he was sleep deprived. He had to rise from sleep at odd hours in the morning just so he could spend private time in prayer to God. And it was that kind of consistency with his teaching that drew so many men to want to know him and to follow him. If Jesus had been a hypocrite, if he had been a liar, nobody would have given him the time of day. And I think we need to try to understand what the character of a liar is. Anyway, I'm actually going to preach a little bit about this on Sunday morning. But think about the times that you weren't honest in your life. Why did you lie? I mean, isn't it always to get some kind of personal gain or to bail us out of some tricky situation? Or maybe we lie to spare the feelings of another individual or to strengthen relationships, preserve social standing, keep us out of trouble, save our neck. Jesus never did those things. He was so honest with people that people stopped following him. That's how honest he was. People would just get up and leave. They couldn't handle it. He was so truthful it cost him relationships. He was so truthful that he hurt people's feelings. And he certainly didn't lie when it could have saved his life. The one time when, from an earthly perspective at least, you would think he would need to lie. He took his claims to the temporary grave. Men lie when it brings them earthly gain and earthly fame. Jesus never had any of that while he was here on earth. And here's something else to kind of think about too. If Jesus was merely lying to gain a following, why would he attempt to start a movement in the one country where it was most frowned upon and where the population was inferior to other countries? In other words, why Judea? Why not go somewhere like Egypt or Greece? I mean, you had a much higher population of people by which to deceive and to gain a following. And not only that, but those guys already believed in all kinds of different gods. Introducing a new god wasn't going to be much of a big deal for them. You're not going to get the kind of fierce persecution in those places like you would get in monotheistic Judea. Those would have been the most strategic places to go if you were trying to start a new movement, because the opposition would have been limited. But he didn't do that. Here's something to consider. There's a historian named Philip Schaff who had a really good answer to the question of whether Jesus was a liar. I like to show these things because these are the kind of things you read and you're thinking, man, I wish I could say something like that. It's so profound. Philip Schaff said this: how in the name of logic, common sense, and experience could an imposter that is a deceitful, selfish, depraved man have invented and consistently maintained from the beginning to the end the purest and noblest character known in history with the most perfect air of truth and reality? How could he have conceived and successfully carried out a plan of unparalleled beneficence, moral magnitude, and sublimity, and sacrificed his own life for it in the face of the strongest prejudices of his people and age? The point is, if we're going to actually use the biographical accounts of Jesus, the evidence there is just non-existent that he was a liar. Not this man. Not with his teaching. Not with his consistent moral character. Any thoughts on that before we keep going? Yeah, man.
I think that's kind of what separates, Jesus from figures like Muhammad. Going back to Schaff's statement, if you look at characters like Muhammad, some of the stuff he did in the Quran was pretty messed up, and Jesus never did anything like that. And you wouldn't be able to make up or lie about a perfect person.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because even though they treat Jesus as a prophet, they still think Muhammad was the greatest of the prophets. No. Not when you, like you said, read the things that Muhammad did and not when you see the things that Jesus did. At the very least, Jesus would have been the greatest of the prophets, infinitely greater. Thanks for bringing it up. That's a really good thought. Anything else? Okay, then how about this? What if Jesus thought he was God and it wasn't true, but he thought that it was? I guess that's the best definition of lunacy I can come up with, right? I mean, we can all claim things that we're mistaken about. I understand that. I used to think I was really cool. We can be wrong about things, can't we? But this is bigger than that type of deception, because in this case, he doesn't just think he's gifted. He thinks he's God. He thinks he can do things God can do. He thinks he has knowledge God does. That's not a small mistake. That's no small error, some minor adjustment that he needs to make. I mean, he thinks he can heal people. He thinks he can forgive sins. He thinks he can die and be resurrected. If he is not God, but he thought he was, that is delusion. It is the best definition of lunacy I know of. And if he is in that position, he would not be a person that is capable of rational thought. And that's important. He could not be a person capable of rational thought. And yet, his teaching propagated throughout the entire world to every generation up until this day. So how do you explain the fact that generation after generation of people have embraced his teaching for 2,000 years? I've mentioned Jim Jones several times in some of our lessons, the guy that misled 900 people to take their lives because they believed him to be the chosen prophet of God. But to my knowledge, nobody is preaching Jim Jones' doctrine today. Why? Because we know he was nuts. We know the same thing about David Koresh. Nobody, to my knowledge, still accepts the claims of David Koresh that he made about himself. But today, we are 2,000 years removed from Jesus' time on earth, and millions upon millions of people are absolutely convinced that he is the Son of God. In the Gospels, Jesus' character doesn't fit that of a lunatic. For one, he showed none of the symptoms of madness that generally accompany people who have mental disorders, meaning there was no paranoia, there was no schizophrenia. He was never rash or impulsive. Rather, Jesus, he was always so calm, so collected, and always composed, even when the heat was on. If he were a lunatic, let me ask this, if he were a lunatic, where do you think the evidence would have shown up the most? I probably have this on the board. Yep, on the cross, okay? So can't answer because you would have cheated. But I mean, that makes sense though, right? That it would have showed up on the cross, the time when he is being tortured the most, that's when it would have showed up. When he was being tortured, mocked, ridiculed, humiliated in front of the masses, but on the cross, he was self-assured. He was in complete control of his senses. He was forgiving towards others. I mean, so amazing was his composure that the centurion, who had seen many men crucified, but seeing how he died, said in Mark 15:39, truly, this was the Son of God. The teaching of Jesus was so profound, so insightful, so intelligent, so reliable, he could not have been delusional. Never had a man spoken the way that he spoke. And think about this. Jesus' teaching, hasn't it set countless people free from mental illness? Hasn't it set people free from alcoholism, from drug addiction? Jesus' teaching has caused sinners to become saints, the spiritually dead to become alive again. Folks, that is not the fruit of a crazy person. It can't be. Here's another one of those profound quotes. A psychiatrist by the name of J.T. Fisher, in examining the gospel accounts, he said this about Jesus. He said, if you were to take the sum total of all authoritative articles ever written by the most qualified of psychologists and psychiatrists on the subject of mental hygiene, if you were to combine them and refine them and cleave out the excess verbiage, if you were to take the whole of the meat, none of the parsley, and if you were to have these unadulterated bits of pure scientific knowledge concisely expressed by the most capable of living poets, you'd have an awkward and incomplete summation of the Sermon on the Mount, and it would suffer immeasurably through comparison. For nearly 2,000 years, the Christian world has been holding in its hand the complete answer to its restless and fruitless yearnings. Here rests the blueprint for successful human life with optimism, mental health, and contentment. And that is absolutely right. Very profound. I wish I'd said that. Right? Really good stuff there. All right. So there's only one option that's left, right? And that's the only reasonable one. Is Jesus Lord? Again, you may think there are other options. For example, sometimes people will say, no, I think he was a good man. He was a good moral teacher. People just got a little carried away with calling him the Son of God. Let me give you another quote. C.S. Lewis, I think some of you will probably recognize this one. C.S. Lewis said this: I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That should be in like single quotes there. Then he says, that is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he's a poached egg. How do you come up with that? Poached egg? I'm like thinking of all the things. But a level of a poached egg. Or else he'd be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come away with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. That's absolutely right. It's not an option. I just don't believe that you can come away from studying the biographical accounts thinking, well, he was a really good man, but he definitely wasn't Son of God. That option is not left open to us because he himself says, I am. So he can't be a liar, he can't be a lunatic, and he is most certainly not a legend. And all that leads us is that he is exactly what he said he was. He's Lord, the Son of God. Is that the first bell? All right. And this means, and again, I'm talking to you as if I would talk to a skeptic, understand that. But this means that every single one of us has to decide for ourselves what we are going to do with that information we have in these biographical accounts. And if I tell a skeptic, if your answer, if your choice is that all this is false, then, you know, you'll certainly want to disclaim everything, you know, that we've been studying and talking about. But you're going to still have to explain how this so-called liar, so-called lunatic, is still proclaimed and followed by so many people, more than any other religious leader in the history of the world. But if it's true, you can believe that he is Lord and follow him, or you can deny it and risk the eternal consequences. Those are your choices. But I don't think he left us with another option. He said in John 12, verse 32, If I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. That was his purpose. Now, we might ask, well, what gives him the right? He's God. That's what gives him the right. So you can follow him or you can deny him, but I'll tell you what you can't do. You can't claim neutrality toward Jesus. This isn't an issue over whether I want to vote in some election or you know, I don't want to do either because I don't like either candidate. That's not a choice that you can make about Jesus. The choice about Jesus is different. You have to make the choice what you're going to think and say about him. Now, that's the brunt of the material. Usually by the time I get to this point in the evidence study, I like to present the gospel to people for the first time. And I'm not going to go through all this with you guys, but I do like to present all this for time's sake to just show what he said you had to do in order to follow him. These are the words of Jesus here. You have to believe, repent, confess, and be baptized. And if some skeptic that I'm studying all this with, we get to this point, if they're ready to do that, we can go ahead and baptize them. But we won't go through the details of that. Couple minutes left. Any thoughts? Nate?
What would you say to someone who says Mark 16:16 shouldn't be in the Bible?
I would ask them why they think that.
I mean, I looked it up. It's like from what I've looked at, the sources I've looked at, it's like a decent argument, in my opinion.
It's a decent argument that it should not be?
In my Bible too, it mentions that there's some opinions about if it should be.
Okay, I know it was not in some translations, but it was in others. So I can't remember. It's been a long time since I've looked at which translations it was in and which one that. Did you look at that when you were studying it?
No.
Okay, yeah. So sometimes what I ask people is, if you don't think it needs to be there, here's a pair of scissors. Go ahead and cut it out and then see what they say. And if they won't do it, then what's the point of having that argument? So, but yeah, I'd be interested to know what, why. Why do you think that? So, yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks, guys. Next week, the resurrection of Jesus. We're going to look at that in detail. Hope that this was encouraging.